Welcome back to another episode of A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Bit of a long chapter today, chapter 18, which of course means more to discuss as well, so this will most likely be the longest episode yet. As usual, I will start the podcast by reading the chapter that we're up to, then that will be followed by a discussion of that chapter. If you want to skip the reading part of the podcast, have a look in the description for the timestamp. That'll be where the discussion starts. Okay, chapter 18 of book 1 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. Countess Rostova, with her daughters and a large number of guests, was already seated in the drawing room. The Count took the gentlemen into his study and showed them his choice collection of Turkish pipes. From time to time he went out to ask, "Hasn't she come yet?" They were expecting Marya Dmitrievna Akhrosimova, known in society as Le Terrible Dragon, a lady distinguished not for wealth or rank, but for common sense and frank plainness of speech. Marya Dmitrievna was known to the imperial family, as well as to all Moscow and Petersburg, and both cities wondered at her, laughed privately at her rudeness, and told good stories about her, while nonetheless all, without exception, respected and feared her. In the Count's room, which was full of tobacco smoke, they talked of the war that had been announced in a manifesto, and about the recruiting. None of them had yet seen the manifesto, but they all knew it had appeared. The Count sat on the sofa between two guests who were smoking and talking. He neither smoked nor talked, but, bending his head first to one side and then to the other, watched the smokers with evident pleasure and listened to the conversation of his two neighbours, whom he egged on against each other. One of them was a sallow, clean-shaven civilian with a thin and wrinkled face, already growing old, though he was dressed like a most fashionable young man. He sat with his legs up on the sofa as if quite at home, and having stuck an amber mouthpiece far into his mouth, was inhaling the smoke spasmodically and screwing up his eyes. This was an old bachelor, Shinshin, a cousin of the Countess's, a man with a sharp tongue, as they said in Moscow society. He seemed to be condescending to his companion. The latter, a fresh, rosy officer of the guards, irreproachably washed, brushed and buttoned, held his pipe in the middle of his mouth, and with red lips gently inhaled the smoke, letting it escape from his handsome mouth in rings. This was Lieutenant Berg, an officer in the Semenov regiment with whom Boris was to travel to join the army, and about whom Natasha had teased her elder sister Vera, speaking of Berg as her intended. The Count sat between them and listened attentively. His favourite occupation, when not playing Boston, a card game he was very fond of, was that of listener, especially when he succeeded in setting two loquacious talkers at one another. "Well then, old chap, Montre Honorable Alphonse Karlovich," said Shinshin, laughing ironically and mixing the most ordinary Russian expressions with the choicest French phrases, which was a peculiarity of his speech. "Vous comptez vous faire de rentes sur l'état. You want to make something out of your company?" The footnote translates this to, "You expect to make an income out of the government." "No, Peter Nikolaevich, I only want to show that in the cavalry the advantages are far less than the infantry. Just consider my own position now, Peter Nikolaevich." Berg always spoke quietly, politely, and with great precision. His conversation always related entirely to himself. He would remain calm and silent when the talk related to any topic that had no direct bearing on himself. He could remain silent for hours without being at all put out of countenance himself, or making others uncomfortable. But as soon as the conversation concerned himself, he would begin to talk circumstantially and with evident satisfaction. "Consider my position, Peter Nikolaevich. Were I in the cavalry, I should get not more than 200 rubles every 4 months, even with the rank of lieutenant. But as it is, I receive 230, said he, looking at Shinshin and the Count with a joyful, pleasant smile. as if it were obvious to him that his success must always be the chief desire of everyone else. Besides that, Peter Nikolaevich, by exchanging into the Guards I shall be in a more prominent position, continued Berg, and vacancies occur much more frequently in the Foot Guards. Then, just think what can be done with 230 rubles. I even managed to put a little aside and send something to my father, he went on, emitting a smoke ring. La balance est. A German knows how to skin a flint, as the proverb says, remarked Shinshin, moving his pipe to the other side of his mouth and winking at the count. The footnotes translates that to, the balance is attained. The count burst out laughing. The other guests, seeing that Shinshin was talking, came up to listen. Berg, oblivious of irony or indifference, continued to explain how by exchanging into the Guards he had already gained a step on his old comrades of the cadet corps, how in wartime the company commander might get killed and he, as the senior in the company, might easily succeed to the post, how popular he was with everyone in the regiment, and how satisfied his father was with him. Berg, evidently, enjoyed narrating all this, and did not seem to suspect that others, too, might have their own interests. But all he said was so prettily sedate, and the naivety of his youthful egotism was so obvious that he disarmed his hearers. Well, my boy, you'll get along wherever you go, foot or horse, that I'll warrant, said Shinshin, patting him on the shoulder and taking his feet off the sofa. Berg smiled joyously. The count, followed by his guests, went into the drawing room. It was just the moment before a big dinner when the assembled guests, expecting the summons to Zakuska, avoid engaging in any long conversation, but think it necessary to move about and talk, in order to show that they are not at all impatient for their food. The host and hostess look towards the door, and now and then glance at one another, and the visitors try to guess from these glances who or what they are waiting for. Some important relation who has not yet arrived, or a dish that is not yet ready. The footnotes here say, Zakuska, or little bite, is the hors d'oeuvres consisting, according to circumstances, of more or less varied choice of snacks, caviar, salt fish, cheese, radishes, or whatnot, with small glasses of vodka and other spirits. It is usually laid on a side table and serves to whet the appetite. Pierre had come just at dinner time and was sitting awkwardly in the middle of the drawing room, on the first chair he had come across, blocking the way for everyone. The Countess tried to make him talk, but he went on naively looking around through his spectacles as if in search of somebody, and answered all her questions in monosyllables. He was in the way and was the only one who did not notice the fact. Most of the guests, knowing of the affair with the bear, looked with curiosity at this big, stout, quiet man, wondering how such a clumsy, modest fellow could have played such a prank on a policeman. "You have only lately arrived?" the Countess asked him. "Oui, madame," replied he, looking around him. "You have not yet seen my husband?" "No, madame." He smiled quite inappropriately. "You have been in Paris recently, I believe. I suppose it's very interesting." "Very interesting." The Countess exchanged glances with Anna Mikhailovna. The latter understood that she was being asked to entertain this young man, and sitting down beside him, she began to speak about his father. But he answered her, as he had the Countess, only in monosyllables. The other guests were all conversing with one another. "The Ruzomovskis. It was very charming. You are very kind. Countess Apraxina," was heard on all sides. The Countess rose and went into the ballroom. "Marya Dmitrievna," came her voice from there. "Herself," came the answer, in a rough voice. And Marya Dmitrievna entered the room. All the unmarried ladies, and even the married ones, except the very oldest, rose. Marya Dmitrievna paused at the door. Tall and stout, holding highly her 50-year-old head with its grey curls, she stood surveying the guests, and leisurely arranged her wide sleeves as if rolling them up. Marya Dmitrievna always spoke in Russian. health and happiness to her whose name day we are keeping and to her children, she said in her loud, full-toned voice which drowned all the others. Well, you old sinner, she went on, turning to the Count, who was kissing her hand, you're feeling dull in Moscow, I dare say. Nowhere to hunt with your dogs. But what is to be done, old man? Just see how these nestlings are growing up. And she pointed to the girls. You must look for husbands for them, whether you like it or not. Well, she said, how's my Cossack? Maria Dmitrievna always called Natasha a Cossack, and she stroked the child's arm as she came up fearless and gay to kiss her hand. I know she's a scamp of a girl, but I like her. She took a pair of pear-shaped ruby earrings from her huge reticule, and having given them to the rosy Natasha, who beamed with the pleasure of her Saint's Day feet, turned away at once and addressed herself to Pierre. The footnote here says, every Russian received the name of one of the saints in the church calendar, and the Saint's Day was the name day of those so christened, and was kept much as a birthday is kept in England.
Friend, come here a bit, said she, assuming a soft, high tone of voice. Come here, my friend.
And she ominously tucked up her sleeves still higher. Pierre approached, looking at her in a childlike way through his spectacles.
Come nearer, friend. I used to be the only one to tell your father the truth when he was in favour, and in your case it is my evident duty.
She paused. All were silent, expectant of what was to follow, for this was clearly only a prelude.
A fine lad, my word, a fine lad. His father lies on his deathbed, and he amuses himself setting a policeman astride a bear.
For shame, sir, for shame. It would be better if you went to the war. She turned away and gave her hand to the Count, who could hardly keep from laughing.
Well, I suppose it is time we were at table, said Maria Dmitrievna.
The Count went in first with Maria Dmitrievna. The Countess followed on the arm of a colonel of hussars, a man of importance to them because Nicholas was to go with him to the regiment. Then came Anna Mikhailovna with Shinshin. Berg gave his arm to Vera. The smiling Julie Karagin went in with Nicholas. After them, other couples followed, filling the whole dining hall, and last of all the children, tutors and governesses, followed singly. The footmen began moving about, chairs scraped, the band struck up in the gallery, and the guests settled down in their places. Then the strains of the Count's household band were replaced by the clatter of knives and forks, the voices of visitors, and the soft steps of the footmen. At one end of the table sat the Countess, with Maria Dmitrievna on her right and Anna Mikhailovna on her left. The other lady visitors were further down. At the other end sat the Count, with the Hussar Colonel on his left, and Shinshin and the other male visitors on his right. Midway down the long table, on one side, sat the grown-up young people, Vera beside Berg and Pierre beside Boris, and on the other side the children, tutors and governesses. From behind the crystal decanters and fruit vases, the Count kept glancing at his wife and her tall cap with its light blue ribbons, and busily filled his neighbour's glasses, not neglecting his own. The Countess, in turn, without omitting her duties as hostess, threw significant glances from behind the pineapples at her husband, whose face and bald head seemed, by their redness, to contrast more than usual with his grey hair. At the ladies' end, an even chatter of voices was heard all the time. At the men's end, the voices sounded louder and louder, especially that of the Colonel of Hussars, who, growing more and more flushed, ate and drank so much that the Count held him up as a pattern to the other guests. Berg, with tender smiles, was saying to Vera that love is not an earthly, but a heavenly feeling. Boris was telling his new friend Pierre who the guests were and exchanging glances with Natasha, who was sitting opposite. Pierre spoke little, but examined the new faces and ate a great deal. Of the two soups, he chose turtle with savoury patties, and went on to the game without omitting a single dish, or one of the wines. These latter, the butter thrust mysteriously forward, wrapped in a napkin from behind the next man's shoulders, and whispered, "Dry Madeira, Hungarian, or Rhine wine, as the case might be. Of the four crystal glasses engraved with the Count's monogram that stood before his plate, Pierre held out one at random and drank with enjoyment, gazing with ever-increasing amiability at the other guests. Natasha, who sat opposite, was looking at Boris as girls of 13 look at the boy they are in love with and have just kissed for the first time. Sometimes that same look fell on Pierre, and that funny, lively little girl's look made him inclined to laugh, without knowing why. Nicholas sat at some distance from Sonia, beside Julie Karagin, to whom he was again talking with the same involuntary smile. Sonia wore a company smile, but was evidently tormented by jealousy. Now she turned pale, now blushed and strained every nerve to overhear what Nicholas and Julie were saying to one another. The governess kept looking around uneasily, as if preparing to resent any slight that might be put upon the children. The German tutor was trying to remember all the dishes, wines, and kinds of dessert, in order to send a full description of the dinner to his people in Germany, and he felt greatly offended when the butler, with a bottle wrapped in a napkin, passed him by. He frowned, trying to appear as if he did not want any of that wine, but was mortified because no one would understand that it was not to quench his thirst or from greediness that he wanted it, but simply from a conscientious desire for knowledge.
All right, there we have it. I'm pretty sure that was the longest chapter we've had so far. But at the same time, I don't think there was too much in there that needs unpacking. We start with the men and the women sitting in separate rooms, sort of killing time until the dinner party starts. Here we see the Count sort of passively observing this conversation between Shin Shin, who is an older man, the cousin of the Countess. He's a character that comes across as a bit sort of smug and condescending. And he's talking to the younger Lieutenant Berg, who is, of course, the love interest of Vera. Berg talks rather boastfully and arrogantly about his career in the military. He talks boastfully about the money he'll make, and about how all he has to do is wait for his superior to be killed, and he can take his place. He doesn't seem to have any inkling at all of the danger that he'll be putting himself in, or that there's any chance that he might then be in a position where he could easily die. Reddit user Domtux said, "The way Berg was talking about infantry had me wondering. I find it weird that these rich people could be in such dangerous positions. Maybe that 230 rubles is good money, but I always see military service as low-paying compared to what I imagine the rest of the aristocrats do. Maybe I don't remember, but I wonder how all these people have made their money anyway. Are they titans of industry or what? Some of them being related to royalty makes sense, I guess, that royalty gets tax money." Reddit user Joyce Haddo replied by saying, "I'm not a historian, so take what I say with a grain of salt. The source of their income was their vast estates in the country, worked on by the serfs, who were in effect slaves. If you recall, in an earlier chapter there was a reference to Pierre's potential fortune, which included 40,000 souls. The work of these serfs generated the fortunes of our friends here in Moscow and St. Petersburg. There were wealthy aristocrats in Moscow who had never even been to visit their lands. These were not like Levin in Anna Karenina, who slept in the fields with his workers during the harvest. As for their being captains of industry, in Russia in the 1800s there was no industry, only agriculture." What a great comment, and that really does enlighten me about the situation there. Especially that last bit about there not being industry yet, just agriculture. If you controlled the farms and the people who worked on those farms, on the land, that's where your fortune was derived from. Another Reddit user, RiverOtter89, said, "Reading the talk of military salaries enlightened me on how generous the Countess Rostov's gift to Anna was." Copperboom11 said, "That's a great point. I assumed it was a large gift, but until you pointed it out, I didn't realize how large. Thanks." So Berg was saying the cavalry in the army would receive 200 rubles every 4 months, which means that the Countess's gift of 700 rubles is the equivalent to 14 months' pay. That certainly is a very generous gift. Later in the chapter, we find everyone assembled waiting for the meal to begin,
And that's where we find Pierre, and he's sort of clumsily sitting in everybody's way, and he's oblivious to the fact that he's in everybody's way. This seems like one of those moments where the author's trying to give you a small sort of a metaphor, or like even just a small echoing of the broader character. Just his mere existence is making everybody have to act around him. And you kind of get the feeling like it's been that way his whole life, to the point where he just doesn't even really realize that it's happening. He is a very naive character. And by the same token, that's kind of what makes him likable. Soon, a guest called Maya arrives, and her reputation has preceded her. Before she arrives, everyone's anticipating the arrival of this horrible woman. She comes in, and she's rude, and she's gruff, and she actually chastises Pierre for his behavior with the bear and the policeman. And then the chapter closes out with everyone proceeding through to the dining table to start the dinner. It was a really good and quite a thorough setup for the next scene. Tolstoy even went to the effort of explaining the seating arrangement of the dinner party. And so I'm quite confident that the upcoming chapter is going to be the dinner party playing out. And you know what I kept thinking of? And this is how you know you're dealing with a very uncultured person right now. I kept thinking of Curb Your Enthusiasm. They always have these dinner party scenes. They set it up. Everyone sits down around the table. And then, you know, there's a bit of a shambles. So that's what I'm anticipating. A Curb Your Enthusiasm style, very amusing dinner party. I must surely draw the weirdest parallels here. But hey, it begs the question, who would be the Larry David of War and Peace? Or the Susie of War and Peace? Or the Ted Danson, or the Jeff? Alright, I'm just amusing myself now. And I'm also aware that there's probably the majority of listeners, or if not a significant minority, have no idea what Curb Your Enthusiasm is, or who Larry David is. Anyway, I'm going to leave the discussion part here. I think that the next chapter will be a continuation of this scene, so we'll pick it back up in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.